as she might have known, remembering how resistant he had been last summer, before Annette married Billy. Now, in frustration, she cried out, "What is wrong with you? I only try to save your life." "You should not have done it," he said. "If I'd let you kill Ralph, you'd have been hanged.
You had no right.
What does it matter if I had the right or not?
That's your father's philosophy, isn't it?"
She was startled.
"What do you mean?"
"Your father believes it doesn't matter whether or not he has the right to do something. If it's for the best, he does it. Like selling you to feed his family.
They sold me to be raped. I tripped you up to save you from the gallows. That's completely different."
"As long as you go on telling yourself that, you'll never understand him or me." She realized she was not going to win back his affection by trying to prove him wrong.
"Well, I don't understand, then.
You took away my power to make my own decisions. You treated me the way your father treated you, as a thing to be controlled, not as a person.
It doesn't matter whether I was right or wrong.
What matters is that it was up to me to decide, not you. But you can't see that, just as your father can't see what he took away from you when he sold you." She still thought the two things were completely different, but she did not argue the point, because she was beginning to see what had made him angry. He was passionate about his independence, something she could empathize with, for she felt the same way, and she had robbed him of that. She said, falteringly,
I think I understand."
"Do you? At any rate, I'll try not to do anything of that kind again."
"Good."
She only half believed she had been wrong, but she was desperate to end the war between them, so she said,
"I'm very sorry."
"All right." He wasn't saying much, but she sensed he might be softening.
"You know that I don't want you to complain to Lord William about Ralph. But if you're determined to, I won't try to stop you."
"I'm glad."
"In fact," she said, "I might be able to help you."
"Oh?" he said.
"How?"
Chapter 36. The home of Lord William and Lady Philippa at Casterham had once been a castle. There was still a round stone keep with battlements, though it was in ruins and used as a cowshed. The wall around the courtyard was intact, but the moat had dried up, and the ground in the slight remaining dip was used to grow vegetables and fruit trees. Where once there had been a drawbridge, a simple ramp now led up to the gatehouse. Gwenda, carrying Sammy, passed under the arch of the gatehouse with Father Gaspard, Billy Howard, Annette, and Wulfric. A young man-at-arms was lolling on a bench, presumably on guard, but he saw the priest's robe and did not challenge them. The relaxed atmosphere encouraged Gwenda. She was hoping to get a private audience with Lady Philippa. They entered the house by the main door and found themselves in a traditional great hall, with high windows like those of a church. It seemed to take up about half the total space of the house. The rest, presumably, would be personal chambers, in the modern fashion, which emphasized the privacy of the noble family and played down military defenses. A middle-aged man in a leather tunic was sitting at a table counting notches on a tally stick. He glanced up at them, finished his count, made a note on a slate, and then said, "Good day to you, strangers."
"Good day, Master Bailiff," said Gaspard, deducing the man's occupation. "We've come to see Lord William."
"He's expected back by supper-time, Father," the bailiff said politely. "What's your business with him, may I ask?"
Gaspard began to explain, and Gwenda slipped back outside. She went around the house to the domestic end. There was a wooden extension that she guessed was the kitchen. A maid sat on a stool by the kitchen door with a sack of cabbages, washing the mud off in a big bowl of water. The maid was young and looked fondly at the baby.
"How old is he?" she said.
4 months, nearly 5. His name is Samuel. We call him Sammy, or Sam."
The baby smiled at the girl, and she said,
"Ah."
Gwenda said, "I'm just an ordinary woman, like you, but I need to speak to the Lady Philippa."
The girl frowned and looked troubled.
"I'm only the kitchen maid," she said.
"But you must see her sometimes. You could speak to her for me." She glanced behind her as if worried about being overheard.
"I don't like to."
Gwenda realized this might be more difficult than she had anticipated.
"Couldn't you just give her a message for me?" she said.
The maid shook her head. Then a voice came from inside.
"Who wants to send me a message?"
Gwenda tensed, wondering if she was in trouble. She looked towards the kitchen door. A moment later, Lady Philippa stepped out. She was not quite beautiful, and certainly not pretty, but she was good-looking. She had a straight nose and a strong jaw, and her green eyes were large and clear. She was not smiling, in fact she wore a slight frown, but nevertheless there was something friendly and understanding about her face. Gwenda answered her question.
"I'm Gwenda from Wigley, my lady."
"Wigley?" Philippa's frown deepened. "And what do you have to say to me?"
"It's about Lord Ralph."
"I was afraid it might be. Well, come inside and let's warm that baby by the kitchen fire." Many noble ladies would have refused to speak to someone as lowly as Gwenda, but she had guessed that Philippa had a big heart underneath that rather formidable exterior. She followed Philippa inside. Sammy began to grizzle, and Gwenda gave him the breast.
"You can sit down," Philippa said.
That was even more unusual. A serf would normally remain standing when talking to a lady. Philippa was being kind because of the baby, Gwenda guessed.
"All right, out with it," Philippa said. "What has Ralph done?" "You may remember, lady, a fight at the Fleece Fair in Kingsbridge last year."
"I certainly do. Ralph groped a peasant girl, and her handsome young fiancé broke his nose. The boy shouldn't have done it, of course, but Ralph is a brute."
"Indeed he is. Last week he came across the same girl, Annette, in the woods.
His squire held her down while Ralph raped her."
"Oh, God save us!" Philippa looked distressed. "Ralph is an animal, a pig, a wild boar. I knew he should never have been made a lord. I told my father-in-law not to promote him."
"A pity the Earl didn't follow your advice. And I suppose the fiancé wants justice." Gwenda hesitated. She was not sure how much of the complicated story to tell, but she sensed it would be a mistake to hold anything back.
"Annette is married, lady, but to a different man."
"So what lucky girl got Mr. Handsome?
As it happens, Wulfric married me."
"Congratulations."
"Though Wulfric is here, with Annette's husband, to bear witness."
Philippa gave Gwenda a sharp look and seemed about to comment, then changed her mind.
"So why have you come here?
Wigley is not in my husband's territory."
"The incident happened in the forest, and the Earl says it was on Lord William's land, so he can't adjudicate."
"That's an excuse. Roland adjudicates anything he likes. He just doesn't want to punish a man he's recently elevated.
Anyway, our village priest is here to tell Lord William what happened. And what do you want me to do?"
"You're a woman. You understand. You know how men make excuses for rape. They say the girl must have been flirting or doing something provocative."
"Yes.
If Ralph gets away with this, he might do it again. Perhaps to me."
"Or me," said Philippa. "You should see the way he stares at me, like a dog looking at a goose on the pond."
That was encouraging. "Perhaps you can make Lord William understand how important it is that Ralph should not get away with this."
Philippa nodded. "I think I can."
Sammy had stopped sucking and gone to sleep. Gwenda stood up.
"Thank you, lady."
"I'm glad you came to me," said Philippa. Lord William summoned them the next morning. They met with him in the great hall. Gwenda was glad to see Lady Philippa sitting beside him. She gave Gwenda a friendly look, and Gwenda hoped that meant she had spoken to her husband. William was tall and black-haired, like his father the Earl, but he was going bald, and the dome above the dark beard and eyebrows suggested a more thoughtful kind of authority, matching his reputation. He examined the blood-stained dress and looked at Annette's bruises, which were blue now, rather than the angry red of 4 days ago. All the same, they brought a look of fury to Lady Philippa's face. Gwenda guessed it was not so much the severity of the injuries as the grim picture they conjured up of a brawny squire kneeling on a girl's arms to hold her down while another man raped her.
"Well, you've done everything correctly so far," William said to Annette. "You went immediately to the nearest village. You showed your injuries to men of good reputation there, and you named your attacker. Now you have to offer a bill to a justice of the peace in the Shiring County Court."
She looked anxious.
"What does that mean?"
"A bill is an accusation, written in Latin."
"I can't write English, Lord, let alone Latin."
"Father Gaspard can do it for you. The justice will put the bill before an indicting jury, and you will tell them what happened. Can you do that? They may ask for embarrassing details." Annette nodded determinedly. "If they believe you, they will order the sheriff to summon Lord Ralph to the court a month later to be tried. Then you will need 2 sureties, people who will pledge a sum of money to guarantee that you will appear at the trial."
"But who will be my sureties?"
"Father Gaspard can be one, and I will be the other. I'll put up the money."
"Thank you, Lord.
Thank my wife, who has persuaded me that I can't allow the king's peace to be breached on my territory by an act of rape." Annette shot a grateful look at Philippa. Gwenda looked at Wulfric. She had told her husband about her conversation with the Lord's wife. Now he met her eye and gave an almost imperceptible nod of acknowledgement. He knew she had made this happen. William went on, "At the trial, you will tell your story again. Your friends will all have to be witnesses. Gwenda will say she saw you coming from the forest in your blood-stained dress. Father Gaspard will say you told him what happened. Wulfric will say he saw Ralph and Alan riding away from the scene." They all nodded solemnly. "One more thing. Having started something like this, you can't stop it. Withdrawing an appeal is an offence, and you would be severely punished, to say nothing of what revenge Ralph might take on you." Annette said, "I won't change my mind. But what will happen to Ralph? How will he be punished?"
"Oh, there's only one penalty for rape," said Lord William. "He'll be hanged."
That night they all slept in the great hall of the castle, with William's servants and squires and dogs, wrapping their cloaks around them and nestling into the carpet of rushes on the floor. As the light from the embers in the huge fireplace dimmed to a glow, Gwenda hesitantly reached for her husband, putting a tentative hand on his arm, stroking the wool of his cloak. They had not made love since the rape, and she was unsure whether he wanted her or not. She had angered him grievously by tripping him up. Would he feel that her intervention with Lady Philippa made up for that? He responded immediately, drawing her to him and kissing her lips. She relaxed gratefully into his arms. They toyed with each other for a while. Gwenda was so happy she wanted to weep. She waited for him to roll on top of her, but he did not do so. She could tell he wanted to, for he was being very affectionate, and his penis was hard in her hand. But perhaps he hesitated to do it in the company of so many others. People did have sex in halls like this, of course. It was normal, and no one took any notice. But perhaps Wulfric felt shy. However, Gwenda was determined to seal the repair of their love, and after a while she climbed onto him, drawing her cloak over them both. As they began to move together, she saw an adolescent boy watching them, wide-eyed, a few yards away. Adults would politely look the other way, of course, but he was at the age where sex was a captivating mystery, and he obviously could not tear his gaze away. Gwenda was feeling so happy that she hardly cared. She met his eye, then smiled at him without ceasing to move. His mouth fell open in shock, and he was struck by agonizing embarrassment. Looking mortified, he rolled over and covered his eyes with his arm. Gwenda pulled her cloak up over her head and Wulfric's, buried her face in his neck, and gave herself up to pleasure. Chapter 37.
Caris felt confident the second time she went to the royal court. The vast interior of Westminster Hall no longer intimidated her, nor did the mass of wealthy and powerful people crowding around the judges' benches. She had been here before. She knew the ropes. Everything that had seemed so strange a year ago was now familiar. She even wore a dress in the London fashion, green on the right side and blue on the left. She enjoyed studying those around her and reading their lives in their faces, cocksure or desperate, bewildered or sly. She could spot people who were new to the capital by their wide-eyed gaze and their air of uncertainty, and she felt pleasantly knowledgeable and superior. If she had any misgivings, they centered on her lawyer, Francis Bookman. He was young and well-informed, and, like most lawyers, she thought, he seemed very sure of himself. A small man with sandy hair, quick in his movements and always ready for an argument, he made her think of a cheeky bird on a window ledge, pecking crumbs and aggressively chasing away rivals. He had told them that their case was incontrovertible. Godwin had Gregory Longfellow, of course. Gregory had won the case against Earl Rowland, and Godwin had naturally asked him to represent the Priory again. He had proved his ability, whereas Bookman was an unknown. However, Caris had a weapon up her sleeve, something that would come as a shock to Godwin. Godwin showed no awareness that he had betrayed Caris, her father, and the entire city of Kingsbridge. He had always presented himself as a reformer, impatient of stick-in-the-mud Prior Antony, sympathetic with the needs of the town, eager for the prosperity of monks and merchants alike. Then, within a year of becoming prior, he had turned to face the opposite way and become even more of a traditionalist than Antony. Yet he appeared to feel no shame. Caris flushed with anger every time she thought of it. He had no right to force the townspeople to use the fulling mill. His other impositions, the ban on handmills, the fines for private fishponds and warrens, were technically correct, albeit outrageously harsh. But the fulling mill should be free, and Godwin knew it. Caris wondered whether he believed that any deceit was pardonable, provided it was done for the sake of God's work. Surely men of God should be more scrupulous about honesty than laymen, not less. She put the point to her father as they hung around the court, waiting for their case to come up. He said, "I never trust anyone who proclaims his morality from the pulpit. That high-minded type can always find an excuse for breaking his own rules. I'd rather do business with an everyday sinner who thinks it's probably to his advantage in the long run to tell the truth and keep his promises. He's not likely to change his mind about that." In moments such as that, when Papa was his old self, Caris realized how much he had changed. Nowadays he was not often shrewd and quick-witted. More usually, he was forgetful and distracted. Caris suspected the decline had begun some months before she had noticed, and it probably accounted for his disastrous failure to anticipate the collapse of the wool market. After several days' wait, they were called before Sir Wilbert Wheatfield, the pink-faced judge with rotten teeth who had ruled for the Priory against Earl Rowland a year ago. Caris's confidence began to ebb away as the judge took his seat on the bench against the east wall. It was frightening that a mere mortal should have such power. If he made the wrong decision, Caris's new cloth manufacturing enterprise would be blighted, her father would be ruined, and no one would be able to pay for the new bridge. Then, as her lawyer began to speak, she started to feel better. Francis commenced with the history of the fulling mill, saying how it had been invented by the legendary Jack Builder, who built the first one, and how Prior Philip had given the townspeople the right to use it free. He then dealt with Godwin's counter-arguments, disarming the prior in advance. "It is true that the mill is in bad repair, slow, and prone to frequent breakdowns," he said. "But how can the prior argue that the people have lost the right to it? The mill is the priory's property, and it is for the priory to keep it in good repair. The fact that he has failed in this duty makes no difference. The people have no right to repair the mill, and they certainly have no obligation so to do. Prior Philip's grant was not conditional." At this point,
Francis produced his secret weapon. In case the prior should attempt to claim that the grant was conditional, I invite the court to read this copy of Prior Philip's will.
Godwin was astonished. He had tried to pretend that the will had been lost, but Thomas Langley had agreed to look for it, as a favour to Merthyn, and he had sneaked it out of the library for a day, time enough for Edmund to have it copied. Carris could not help enjoying the look of shock and outrage on Godwin's face when he found that his deception had been foiled. He stepped forward and said indignantly, "How was this obtained?" The question was revealing. He did not ask, "Where was it found?" which would have been the logical inquiry if it had really been lost. Gregory Longfellow looked annoyed, and waved at him with a hushing gesture, and Godwin closed his mouth and stepped back, realizing he had given himself away. But it was surely too late, Carris thought. The judge must see that the only reason for Godwin to be angry was that he knew the document favoured the townspeople and had attempted to suppress it. Francis wound up quickly after that. A good decision, Carris thought, for Godwin's duplicity would be fresh in the judge's mind, while Gregory made the case for the defence. But Gregory's approach took them all completely by surprise. He stepped forward and said to the judge, "Sir, Kingsbridge is not a chartered borough." He stopped there, as if that was all he had to say. It was true, technically. Most towns had a royal charter giving them the freedom to trade and hold markets, without obligations to the local earl or baron. Their citizens were free men, owing allegiance to no one but the king. However, a few towns, such as Kingsbridge, remained the property of an overlord, usually a bishop or a prior. St. Albans and Bury St. Edmunds were examples. Their status was less clear. The judge said, "That makes a difference. Only free men can appeal to the royal court. What do you have to say to that, Francis Bookman? Are your clients serfs?" Francis turned to Edmund. In a low, urgent voice, he said, "Have the townspeople appealed to the royal court before?" "No, the prior has, but not the parish guild, even before your time. There's no record of it, so we can't argue from precedent. Damn!" Francis turned back to the judge. His face changed from worried to confident in a flash, and he spoke as if condescending to deal with something trivial. "Sir, the townspeople are free. They enjoy burgess tenure." Gregory said quickly, "There is no universal pattern of burgess tenure. It means different things in different places." The judge said, "Is there a written statement of customs?" Francis looked at Edmund, who shook his head. "No prior would ever agree to such things being written down," he muttered. Francis turned back to the judge. "There is no written statement, sir, but clearly..." "Then this court must decide whether or not you are free men," the judge said. Edmund spoke directly to the judge. "Sir, the citizens have the freedom to buy and sell their homes." This was an important right not granted to serfs, who needed their lord's permission. Gregory said, "But you have feudal obligations. You must use the prior's mills and fish ponds." Sir Wilbert said, "Forget fish ponds. The key factor is the citizen's relationship to the system of royal justice. Does the town freely admit the king's sheriff?" Gregory answered that, "No. He must ask permission to enter the town." Edmund said indignantly, "That is the prior's decision, not ours." Sir Wilbert said, "Very well. Do the citizens serve on royal juries or claim exemption?" Edmund hesitated. Godwin looked exultant. Serving on juries was a time-consuming chore that everyone avoided if they could. After a pause, Edmund said, "We claim exemption." "Then that settles the matter," the judge said. "If you refuse that duty on the grounds that you are serfs, you cannot appeal over the head of your landlord to the king's justice." Gregory said triumphantly, "In the light of that, I beg you to dismiss the townspeople's application." "So ruled," said the judge. Francis appeared outraged. "Sir, may I speak?" "Certainly not," said the judge. "But, sir,
Another word, and I'll hold you in contempt.
Francis closed his mouth and bowed his head.
Sir Wilbert said, Next case.
Another lawyer began to speak. Caris was dazed. Francis addressed her and her father in tones of protest.
You should have told me you were serfs.
We're not.
The judge has just ruled that you are. I can't win cases on partial information.
She decided not to squabble with him. He was the type of young man who cannot admit a mistake. Godwin was so pleased with himself that he looked as if he might burst. As he left, he could not resist a parting shot. He wagged a finger at Edmund and Caris.
I hope that, in future, you'll see the wisdom of submitting to the will of God, he said solemnly.
Caris said, Oh, piss off, and turned her back. She spoke to her father.
This makes us completely powerless. We proved we had the right to use the fulling mill free, but Godwin can still withhold that right.
So it seems, he said. She turned to Francis.
There must be something we can do, she said angrily.
Well, he said, you could get Kingsbridge made into a proper borough, with a royal charter setting out your rights and freedoms. Then you would have access to the royal court.
Caris saw a glimmer of hope.
How do we go about that?
You apply to the king. Would he grant it?
If you argued that you need this to be able to pay your taxes, he would certainly listen.
Then we must try. Edmund warned, Godwin will be furious.
Let him, Caris said grimly.
Don't underestimate the challenge, her father persisted. You know how ruthless he is, even over small disputes. Something like this will lead to total war.
So be it, said Caris bleakly. Total war.
Oh, Ralph! How could you do it?
Said his mother. Merthyn studied his brother's face in the dim light of their parents' home. Ralph appeared torn between outright denial and self-justification. In the end, Ralph said, She led me on. Maud was distressed more than angry.
But Ralph, she is another man's wife.
A peasant's wife.
Even so.
Don't worry, Mother, they'll never convict a lord on the word of a serf.
Merthyn was not so sure. Ralph was a minor lord, and it seemed he had incurred the enmity of William of Castor. There was no telling how the trial would come out.
Their father said sternly, Even if they don't convict you, which I pray for, just think of the shame of it. You're the son of a knight. How could you forget that?
Merthyn was horrified and upset, but not surprised. That streak of violence had always been in Ralph's nature. In their boyhood, he had ever been ready for a fight, and Merthyn had often steered him away from fisticuffs, deflating a confrontation with a conciliatory word or a joke. Had anyone other than his brother committed this horrible rape, Merthyn would have been hoping to see the man hang. Ralph kept glancing at Merthyn. He was worried about Merthyn's disapproval, perhaps more so than his mother's. He had always looked up to his older brother. Merthyn just wished there was some way Ralph could be shackled to prevent his attacking people, now that he no longer had Merthyn nearby to keep him out of trouble. The discussion with their distraught parents was set to go on for some time. But there was a knock at the door of the modest house, and Caris came in. She smiled at Gerald and Maud, though her face changed when she saw Ralph. Merthyn guessed she wanted him. He stood up.
I didn't know you were back from London, he said.
Just arrived, she replied. Can we have a few words?
He pulled a cloak around his shoulders and stepped outside with her into the dim grey light of a cold December day. It was a year since she had terminated their love affair. He knew that her pregnancy had ended in the hospital, and he guessed she had somehow brought on the abortion deliberately. Twice in the following few weeks, he had asked her to come back to him, but she had refused. It was bewildering. He sensed that she still loved him, but she was adamant. He had given up hope and assumed that in time he would cease to grieve. So far, that had not happened. His heart still beat faster when he saw her,
and he was happier talking to her than doing anything else in the world. They walked to the main street and turned into the Bell. In the late afternoon, the tavern was quiet. They ordered hot, spiced wine. "We lost the case," Caris said. Merthyn was shocked. "How is that possible? You had Prior Philip's will." "It made no difference." She was bitterly disappointed, Merthyn could see. She explained, "Godwin's smart lawyer argued that Kingsbridge people are serfs of the Prior, and serfs have no right to appeal to the royal court. The judge dismissed the case." Merthyn felt angry. "But that's stupid. It means the Prior can do anything he likes, regardless of laws and charters." "I know." Merthyn realized she was impatient because he was saying things she had said to herself many times. He suppressed his indignation and tried to be practical. "What are you going to do?" "Apply for a borough charter. That would free the town from the control of the Prior. Our lawyer thinks we have a strong case. Mind you, he thought we would win against the Fulling Mill. However, the king is desperate for money for this war against France. He needs prosperous towns to pay his taxes." "How long would it take to get a charter?" "That's the bad news. At least a year, perhaps more. And in that time, you can't manufacture scarlet cloth. Not with the old Fulling Mill. So we'll have to stop work on the bridge. I can't see any way out of it. Damn!" It seemed so unreasonable. Here they had, at their fingertips, the means to restore the town's prosperity, and one man's stubbornness was preventing them. "How we all misjudged Godwin," Merthyn said. "Don't remind me. We've got to escape from his control." "I know. But sooner than a year from now. I wish there was a way." Merthyn racked his brains. At the same time, he was studying Caris. She was wearing a new dress from London, party-coloured in the current fashion, which gave her a playful look, even though she was solemn and anxious. The colours, deep green and mid-blue, seemed to make her eyes sparkle and her skin glow. This happened every so often. He would be deep in conversation with her over some problem to do with the bridge. They rarely talked of anything else. Then suddenly he would realize how lovely she was. Even while he was thinking about that, the problem-solving part of his mind came up with a proposal. "We should build our own Fulling Mill." Caris shook her head. "It would be illegal. Godwin would order John Constable to pull it down." "What if it were outside the town?" "In the forest, you mean? That's illegal, too. You'd have the king's verderers on your back." "Verderers enforced the laws of the forest." "Not in the forest, then. Somewhere else. Wherever you went, you'd need the permission of some lord. My brother's a lord." A look of distaste crossed Caris's face at the mention of Ralph. Then her expression changed as she thought through what Merthyn was saying. "Build a fulling mill at Wigley." "Why not? Is there a fast-flowing stream to turn the mill wheel?" "I believe so. But if not, it can be driven by an ox, like the ferry." "Would Ralph let you?" "Of course. He's my brother. If I ask him, he'll say yes." "Godwin will go mad with rage." "Ralph doesn't care about Godwin." Caris was pleased and excited, Merthyn could see. But what were her feelings towards him? She was glad they had a solution to their problem, and eager to outwit Godwin. But beyond that, he could not read her mind. "Let's think this through before we rejoice," she said. "Godwin will make a rule saying cloth can't be taken out of Kingsbridge to be fulled. Lots of towns have laws like that. Very hard for him to enforce such a rule without the cooperation of a guild. And, if he does, you can get around it. Most of the cloth is being woven in the villages anyway, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"Then don't bring it into the city. Send it from the weavers to Wigley. Dye it there. Pull it in the new mill, then take it to London. Godwin will have no jurisdiction."
"How long would it take to build a mill?"
Merthyn considered. "The timber building can be put up in a couple of days. The machinery will be wooden too, but it will take longer, as it has to be precisely measured. Getting the men and materials there will take the most time. I could have it finished a week after Christmas."
"That's wonderful,"
she said. We'll do it.
Elizabeth rolled the dice and moved her last counter into the home position on the board.
I win, she said. That's 3 out of 3. Pay up.
Merthin handed her a silver penny. Only 2 people ever beat him at tabula, Elizabeth and Caris. He did not mind losing. He was grateful for a worthy opponent. He sat back and sipped his pear wine. It was a cold Saturday afternoon in January and already dark. Elizabeth's mother was asleep in a chair near the fire, snoring gently with her mouth open. She worked at the bell, but she was always at home when Merthin visited her daughter. He preferred it that way. It meant he never had to decide whether to kiss Elizabeth or not. It was a question he did not want to confront. He would have liked to kiss her, of course. He remembered the touch of her cool lips and the firmness of her flat breasts. But it would mean admitting that his love affair with Caris was over forever, and he was not yet ready for that.
How is the new mill at Wagley?
Elizabeth asked.
Finished and rolling, Merthin said proudly. Caris has been fulling cloth there for a week.
Elizabeth raised her eyebrows.
Herself?
No, that was a figure of speech. As a matter of fact, Mark Webber is running the mill, though he is training some of the village men to take over.
It will be good for Mark if he becomes Caris's second in command. He's been poor all his life. This is a big opportunity.
Caris's new enterprise will be good for us all. It will mean I can finish the bridge.
She's a clever girl,
Elizabeth said in a level voice. But what does Godwin have to say?
Nothing. I'm not sure he knows about it yet. He will, though.
I don't believe there's anything he can do.
He's a prideful man. If you've outwitted him, he'll never forgive you.
I can live with that.
And what about the bridge?
Despite all the problems, the work is only a couple of weeks behind schedule. I've had to spend money to catch up, but we will be able to use the bridge, with a temporary wooden roadbed, for the next fleece fair.
You and Caris between you have saved the town.
Not yet, but we will. There was a knock at the door, and Elizabeth's mother woke up with a start.
Now how could that be? She said. It's dark out.
It was one of Edmund's apprentice boys.
Master Merthin is wanted at the parish guild meeting, he said.
What for? Merthin asked him.
Master Edmund said to tell you, you're wanted at the parish guild meeting, the boy said.
He had obviously learned the message off by heart and knew nothing more.
Something about the bridge, I expect, Merthin said to Elizabeth. They're worried about the cost.
He picked up his cloak. Thank you for the wine. And the game.
I'll play you any time you like, she said.
He walked beside the apprentice to the guild hall on the high street. The guild was holding a business meeting, not a banquet. The 20 or so most important people in Kingsbridge were sitting at a long trestle table, some drinking ale or wine, talking in low voices. Merthin sensed tension and anger, and he became apprehensive. Edmund was at the head of the table. Prior Godwin sat next to him. The prior was not a member of the guild. His presence suggested that Merthin's surmise had been right, and the meeting was about the bridge. However, Thomas the Matricularius was not present, although Philemon was. That was odd. Merthin had recently had a small dispute with Godwin. His contract had been for 1 year at 2d a day plus the lease on Leper Island. It was due for renewal, and Godwin had proposed to continue paying him 2d a day. Merthin had insisted on 4d, and in the end Godwin had conceded the point. Had he complained about this to the guild? Edmund spoke with characteristic abruptness.
We've called you here because Prior Godwin wishes to dismiss you as master builder in charge of the bridge.
Merthin felt as if he had been punched in the face. He was not expecting anything like this.
What? He said. But Godwin appointed me.
Godwin said, and therefore I have the right to dismiss you.
But why?
The work is behind schedule and over budget.
It's behind schedule because the Earl closed the quarry, and it's over budget because I had to spend money to catch up.
Excuses. Am I inventing the death of a carter?
Godwin shot back.
Killed by your own brother. What has that to do with anything?
Godwin ignored the question. "A man who is accused of rape," he added. "You can't dismiss a master builder because of his brother's behavior." "Who are you to say what I can do? I'm the builder of your bridge."
Then it occurred to Merthyn that much of his work as master builder was complete. He had designed all the most complicated parts and made wooden templates to guide the stonemasons. He had built the cofferdams, which no one else knew how to do, and he had constructed the floating cranes and hoists needed to move the heavy stones into position in midstream. Any builder could now finish the job, he realized with dismay.
"There is no guarantee of renewal of your contract," Godwin said.
It was true. Merthyn looked around the room for support. No one would meet his eye. They had already argued this out with Godwin, he deduced. Despair overwhelmed him. Why had this happened? It was not because the bridge was behind schedule and over budget. The delay was not Merthyn's fault, and anyway he was catching up. What was the real reason? As soon as he had asked the question, the answer came into his mind. "This is because of the fulling mill at Wigley," he said. Godwin said primly, "The two things are not necessarily connected." Edmund said quietly but distinctly, "Lying monk." Philemon spoke for the first time.
"Take care, Alderman," he said.
Edmund was undeterred. "Merthyn and Carris outwitted you, didn't they, Godwin? Their mill at Wigley is entirely legitimate. You brought defeat on yourself by your greed and obstinacy. And this is your revenge." Edmund was right. No one was as capable a builder as Merthyn. Godwin must know that, but clearly he did not care. "Who will you hire instead of me?" Merthyn asked. Then he answered the question himself. "Elfric, I suppose." "That has to be decided," Edmund said. "Another lie." Philemon spoke again, his voice more shrill.
"You can be brought before the ecclesiastical court for talk like that."
Merthyn wondered if this might be no more than a move in the game, a way for Godwin to renegotiate his contract. He said to Edmund, "Is the parish guild in agreement with the prior on this?" Godwin said, "It is not for them to agree or disagree." Merthyn ignored him and looked expectantly at Edmund. Edmund was shamefaced. "It cannot be denied that the prior has the right. The guildsmen are financing the bridge by loans, but the prior is overlord of the town." This was agreed from the start. Merthyn turned to Godwin. "Do you have anything else to say to me, Lord Prior?" He waited, hoping in his heart that Godwin would come out with his real demands. But Godwin said stonily, "No." "Good night, then." He waited a second longer. No one spoke. The silence told him it was all over. He left the room. Outside the building, he took a deep breath of the cold night air. He could hardly believe what had happened. He was no longer master of the bridge. He walked through the dark streets. It was a clear night, and he could find his way by starlight. He walked past Elizabeth's house. He did not want to talk to her. He hesitated outside Carris's, but passed that too and went down to the waterside. His small rowing boat was tied up opposite Leper Island. He got in and rowed himself across. When he reached his house, he paused outside and looked up at the stars, fighting back tears. The truth was that in the end he had not outwitted Godwin, rather the reverse. He had underestimated the lengths to which the prior would go to punish those who opposed him. Merthyn had thought himself clever, but Godwin had been cleverer, or at least more ruthless. He was prepared to damage the town and the priory, if necessary, to avenge a wound to his pride, and that had given him victory. Merthyn went inside and lay down, alone and beaten. Chapter 38. Ralph lay awake all through the night before his trial. He had seen many people die by hanging.
Every year, 20 or 30 men and a few women rode the sheriff's cart from the prison in Shiring Castle down the hill to the market square, where the gallows stood waiting. It was a common occurrence, but those men had remained in Ralph's memory, and on this night they returned to torment him. Some died fast, their necks snapped by the drop, but not many. Most strangled slowly. They kicked and struggled and opened their mouths wide in silent, breathless screaming. They pissed and shat themselves. He recalled an old woman convicted of witchcraft. When she dropped, she bit right through her tongue and spat it out, and the crowd around the gallows had backed away in fright from the bloody lump of flesh as it flew through the air and fell on the dusty ground. Everyone told Ralph he was not going to be hanged, but he could not get the thought out of his mind. People said that Earl Rowland could not allow one of his lords to be executed on the word of a serf. However, so far the Earl had done nothing to intervene. The preliminary jury had returned an indictment against Ralph to the Justice of the Peace in Shiring. Like all such juries, it had consisted mainly of knights of the county owing allegiance to Earl Rowland. But, despite this, they had acted on the evidence of the Wigley peasants. The men, jurors were never women, of course, had not flinched from indicting one of their own. In fact, the jurors had shown, by their questions, some distaste for what Ralph had done, and several had refused to shake his hand afterwards. Ralph had planned to prevent Annette testifying again at the trial proper by imprisoning her in Wigley before she could leave for Shiring. However, when he went to her house to seize her, he found she had already departed. She must have anticipated his move and left earlier to foil him. Today, another jury would hear the case, but, to Ralph's dismay, at least four of the men had been on the preliminary jury too. Since the evidence on both sides was likely to be exactly the same, he could not see how this group could return a different verdict, unless some kind of pressure was put on the jurors, and it was getting very late for that. He got up at first light and went downstairs to the ground floor of the courthouse inn on the market square of Shiring. He found a shivering boy breaking the ice on the well in the backyard and told him to fetch bread and ale. Then he went to the communal dormitory and woke his brother, Merthyn. They sat together in the cold parlour, with the stale smell of last night's ale and wine, and Ralph said, "I'm afraid they'll hang me." "So am I," said Merthyn. "I don't know what to do." The boy brought two tankards and half a loaf. Ralph picked up his ale in a shaking hand and took a long draught. Merthyn ate some bread automatically, frowning and looking upwards out of the corners of his eyes, in the way he always did when he was racking his brains. "The only thing I can think of is to try to persuade Annette to drop the charge and come to a settlement. You'll have to offer her compensation." Ralph shook his head. "She can't back out. It's not allowed. They'll punish her if she does." "I know. But she could deliberately give weak evidence, making room for doubt. That's how it's usually done, I believe." Hope sparked in Ralph's heart. "I wonder if she would consent." The pot boy brought in an armful of logs and knelt before the fireplace to start a fire. Merthyn said thoughtfully, "How much money could you offer, Annette?" "I've got 20 florins. That was worth 3 pounds of English silver pennies. Merthyn ran a hand through his untidy red hair. "It's not much. It's a lot to a peasant girl. On the other hand, her family are rich for peasants. Doesn't Wigley yield you much money? I've had to buy armour. When you're a lord, you need to be ready to go to war. I could lend you money." "How much have you got?" 13 pounds. Ralph was so astonished that for a moment he forgot his troubles. "Where did you get all that?" Merthyn looked faintly resentful. "I work hard and I'm paid well." "But you were sacked as master builder of the bridge." "There's plenty more work. And I rent out land on Leper Island." Ralph was indignant. "So a carpenter is richer than a lord." "Luckily for you, as it happens." "How much do you think Annette will want?" Ralph thought of a snag, and his spirits fell again.
It's not her. It's Wulfric. He's the ringleader in this.
Of course. Merthyn had spent a lot of time in Wigley while building the fulling mill, and he knew that Wulfric had married Gwenda only after being jilted by Annet. Then let's talk to him. Ralph did not think it would do any good, but he had nothing to lose. They went out into the bleak grey daylight, pulling their cloaks around their shoulders against a cold February wind. They crossed the marketplace and entered the Bull, where the Wigley folk were staying, paid for, Ralph presumed, by Lord William, without whose help they would not have begun this process. But Ralph had no doubt that his real enemy was William's voluptuous, malevolent wife, Philippa, who seemed to hate Ralph, even though, or perhaps because, he found her fascinating and alluring. Wulfric was up, and they found him eating porridge with bacon. When he saw Ralph, his face turned thunderous, and he rose from his seat. Ralph put his hand on his sword, ready to fight, there and then, but Merthyn hastily stepped forward, holding his hands open in front of him in a conciliatory gesture. "I come as a friend, Wulfric," he said. "Don't get angry, or you'll end up on trial instead of my brother." Wulfric remained standing with his hands at his sides. Ralph was disappointed. The agony of his suspense would have been eased by a fight. Wulfric spat a piece of bacon rind on the floor and swallowed, then said, "What do you want, if not trouble?" "To make a settlement. Ralph is willing to pay Annet £10 by way of recompense for what he did." Ralph was startled by the amount. Merthyn would have to pay most of it, but he showed no hesitation. Wulfric said, "Annet can't withdraw the charge. It's not allowed. But she can alter her evidence. If she says that at first she consented, then changed her mind when it was too late, the jury wouldn't convict Ralph." Ralph watched Wulfric's face eagerly for a sign of willingness, but his expression remained stony, and he said, "So you're offering her a bribe to commit perjury?" Ralph began to despair. He could see that Wulfric did not want Annet to be paid money. Revenge was his aim, not compensation. He wanted a hanging. Merthyn said reasonably, "I'm offering her a different kind of justice. You're trying to get your brother off the hook. Wouldn't you do the same? You had a brother once." Ralph recalled that Wulfric's brother had been killed, along with his parents, when the bridge collapsed. Merthyn went on, "Wouldn't you try to save his life, even if he had done wrong?" Wulfric appeared startled by this appeal to family feeling. Clearly it had never occurred to him to think of Ralph as someone with kinfolk who loved him, but he recovered after a moment and said, "My brother David would never have done what Ralph did." "Of course," Merthyn said soothingly. "All the same, you can't blame me for wanting to find a way to save Ralph, especially if it can be managed without doing an injustice to Annet." Ralph admired his brother's smooth way of talking. He could charm a bird out of a tree, he thought. But Wulfric was not easily persuaded. "The villagers want to see the back of Ralph. They're afraid he might do the same thing again." Merthyn sidestepped that. "Perhaps you should put our offer to Annet. It should be her decision, surely." Wulfric looked thoughtful. "How could we be certain you would pay the money?" Ralph's heart leaped. Wulfric was softening. Merthyn replied, "We'll give the cash to Carys Wooler before the trial. She will pay Annet after Ralph is declared innocent. You trust Carys, and we do too." Wulfric nodded. "As you say, it's not my decision. I'll put it to her." He went upstairs. Merthyn let out his breath in a long sigh. By heaven, there's an angry man. "You talked him round, though," Ralph said admiringly. "He's only agreed to pass on a message." They sat at the table Wulfric had vacated. A potboy asked them if they wanted breakfast, but they both refused. The parlour was full of guests, calling for ham and cheese and ale. The inns were crowded with people attending the court. Unless they had a good excuse, all the knights of the shire were obliged to come, as were most other prominent men of the county, senior clergymen, wealthy merchants, and anyone with an income over £40 a year. Lord William, Prior Godwin, and Edmund Wooler were all included. Ralph and Merthyn's father, Sir Gerald, had been a regular attender before his fall from grace. They had to offer themselves as jurors and transact other business, such as paying their taxes or electing their members of Parliament. In addition, there was a host of accused men, victims, witnesses, and sureties. A court brought a lot of business to the inns of a town. Wulfric kept them waiting. Ralph said, "What do you think they're talking about up there?" Merthyn said, "Annette may be inclined to take the money. Her father would support her in that, and perhaps her husband, Billy Howard, too. But Wulfric is the type who thinks telling the truth is more important than money. His wife, Gwenda, will support him out of loyalty, and Father Gaspard will do the same on principle. Most importantly, they'll have to consult Lord William, and he'll do what Lady Philippa wants. She hates you for some reason. On the other hand, a woman is more likely to choose reconciliation over confrontation. So it could go either way."
"Exactly."
The patrons of the inn finished their breakfasts and began to drift out, heading across the square to the courthouse inn, where the session would be held. Soon it would be too late. At last, Wulfric reappeared. "She says no," he said abruptly, and he turned away.
"Just a minute," Merthyn said.
Wulfric took no notice and disappeared again up the stairs. Ralph cursed. For a while he had hoped for a reprieve. Now he was in the hands of the jury. He heard the sound of a handbell being rung vigorously outside. A sheriff's deputy was summoning all concerned to the court. Merthyn stood up. Reluctantly, Ralph followed suit. They walked back to the courthouse and went into the large back room. At the far end, the justice's bench stood on a raised dais. Although always called a bench, it was in fact a carved wooden chair like a throne. The justice was not seated, but his clerk was at a table in front of the dais, reading a scroll. Two long benches for the jurymen stood to one side. There were no other seats in the room. Everyone else would stand wherever he wished. Order was maintained by the power of the justice to sentence instantly anyone who misbehaved. No trial was necessary for a crime that the judge had himself witnessed. Ralph spotted Alan Fernhill, looking terrified, and stood beside him without speaking. Ralph began to think he should never have come here. He could have made an excuse. Sickness. A misunderstanding about dates. A horse lamed on the road. But that would only have brought him a postponement. Eventually the sheriff would come, with armed deputies to arrest him, and if he evaded them, he would be declared an outlaw. However, that was better than hanging. He wondered if he should flee now. He could probably fight his way out of the tavern, but he would not get far on foot. He would be chased by half the town, and if they did not catch him, the sheriff's deputies would follow on horseback, and his flight would be seen as an admission of guilt. As things stood, he still had a chance of acquittal. Annette might be too intimidated to give her evidence clearly. Perhaps key witnesses would fail to show up. There could be some last-minute intervention by Earl Rowland. The courtroom filled up. Annette, the villagers, Lord William and Lady Philippa, Edmund Wooler and Carys, Prior Godwin and his slimy assistant Philemon. The clerk banged on his table for quiet, and the justice came through a side door. It was Sir Guy de Bois, a large landholder. He had a bald head and a fat belly. He was an old comrade-in-arms of the Earl's, which might stand in Ralph's favour. But on the other side of the balance, he was Lady Philippa's uncle, and she might have whispered malice in his ear. He had the flushed look of a man who has breakfasted on salt beef and strong ale. He sat down, farted loudly, sighed with satisfaction, and said, "All right, let's get on with it." Earl Rowland was not present. Ralph's case came first. It was the one that most interested everybody, including the justice. The indictment was read, and Annette was called to give her evidence. Ralph found it strangely difficult to concentrate. He had heard it all before, of course, but he should have been listening hard for any discrepancy in the story Annette told today, any sign of uncertainty, any hesitation or faltering. but he felt fatalistic. His enemies were out in full force. His one powerful friend, Earl Rowland, was absent. Only his brother stood beside him, and Merthyn had already tried his best to help and failed. Ralph was doomed. The witnesses followed: Gwenda, Wulfric, Peg, Gaspard. Ralph had thought he had absolute power over these people, but somehow they had conquered him. The foreman of the jury, Sir Herbert Montaigne, was one of those who had refused to shake Ralph's hand, and he asked questions that seemed designed to emphasize the horror of the crime. How bad was the pain? How much blood? Was she weeping? When it was Ralph's turn to speak, he told the story that had been disbelieved by the jury of indictment, and he told it in a low voice, stumbling over his words. Alan Fernhill did better, saying firmly that Annette had been eager to lie with Ralph, and that the two lovers had asked him to make himself scarce while they enjoyed one another's favors beside the stream. But the jury did not believe him. Ralph could tell by their faces. He began to feel almost bored by the proceedings, wishing they would be over, and his fate sealed. As Alan stepped back, Ralph was conscious of a new figure at his shoulder, and a low voice said, "Listen to me." Ralph glanced behind and saw Father Jerome, the Earl's clerk, and the thought crossed his mind that a court such as this had no power over priests, even if they committed crimes. The justice turned to the jury and asked for their verdict. Father Jerome murmured, "Your horses stand outside, saddled and ready to go." Ralph froze. Was he hearing correctly? He turned and said, "What?" "Run for it." Ralph looked behind him. 100 men barred his way to the door, many of them armed. "It's not possible. Use the side door," Jerome said, indicating with a slight inclination of his head the entrance through which the justice had come. Ralph saw immediately that only the Wigley people stood between him and the side door. The foreman of the jury, Sir Herbert, stood up, looking self-important. Ralph caught the eye of Alan Fernhill standing beside him. Alan had heard everything and looked expectant. "Go now," whispered Jerome. Ralph put his hand on his sword. "We find Lord Ralph of Wigley guilty of rape," said the foreman. Ralph drew his sword. Waving it in the air, he dashed for the door. There was a second of stunned silence, then everyone shouted at once. But Ralph was the one man in the room with a weapon in his hand, and he knew it would take the others a moment to draw. Only Wulfric tried to stop him, stepping into his path heedlessly, not even looking scared, just determined. Ralph raised his sword and brought it down as hard as he could, aiming at the middle of Wulfric's skull, intending to cleave it in two. But Wulfric stepped nimbly back and to the side. Nevertheless, the point of the sword sliced through the left side of his face, cutting it open from the temple to the jaw. Wulfric cried out in sudden agony, and his hands flew to his cheek, and then Ralph was past him. He flung open the door, stepped through, and turned. Alan Fernhill dashed past him. The foreman of the jury was close behind Alan, sword drawn and raised. Ralph experienced a moment of pure elation. This was how things should be settled, by a fight, not a discussion. Win or lose, he preferred it this way. With a yell of exhilaration, he thrust at Sir Herbert. The point of his sword touched the foreman's chest, ripping through his leather tunic, but the man was too distant for the blow to penetrate the ribs, and it merely cut his skin, then glanced off the bones. All the same, Herbert cried out, more in fear than pain, and stumbled back, colliding with those behind him. Ralph slammed the door on them. He found himself in a passage that ran the length of the house, with a door to the market square at one end and another to the stable yard at the other. Where were the horses? Jerome had said only that they were outside. Alan was already running for the back door, so Ralph followed. As they burst into the yard, a hubbub behind them told him that the courtroom door had been opened and the crowd was after him. There was no sign of their horses in the yard. Ralph ran under the arch that led to the front. There stood the most welcome sight in the world. his hunter, Griff, saddled and pawing the ground, with Alan's 2-year-old Fletch beside him, both held by a barefoot stable boy with his mouth full of bread. Ralph seized the reins and jumped on his horse. Alan did the same. They kicked their beasts just as the mob from the courtroom came through the arch. The stable boy threw himself out of the way, terrified. The horses surged forward and away. Someone in the crowd threw a knife. It stuck a quarter of an inch into Griff's flank, then fell away, serving only to spur the horse on. They galloped flat out through the streets, scattering townspeople before them, careless of men, women, children, and livestock. They charged through a gate in the old wall and passed into a suburb of houses interspersed with gardens and orchards. Ralph looked behind. No pursuers were in sight. The sheriff's men would come after them, of course, but they had first to fetch horses and saddle them. Ralph and Alan were already a mile from the market square, and their mounts showed no signs of tiring. Ralph was filled with glee. 5 minutes ago he had reconciled himself to being hanged. Now he was free. The road forked. Choosing at random, Ralph turned left. A mile away across the fields, he could see woodland. Once there, he would turn off the track and disappear. But what would he do then? Chapter 39 Earl Rowland was clever, Merthyn said to Elizabeth Clark. He allowed justice to take its course almost to the end. He didn't bribe the judge or influence the jury or intimidate the witnesses, and he avoided a quarrel with his son, Lord William. But he escaped the humiliation of seeing one of his men hanged. "Where is your brother now?" she said. "No idea. I haven't spoken to him or even seen him since that day." They were sitting in Elizabeth's kitchen on Sunday afternoon. She had made dinner for him, boiled ham with stewed apples and winter greens, and a small jug of wine that her mother had bought, or perhaps stolen, from the inn where she worked. Elizabeth said, "What will happen now?" The sentence of death still hangs over him. He can't return to Wigley or come here to Kingsbridge without getting arrested. In effect, he's declared himself an outlaw. Is there nothing he can do? He could get a pardon from the king, but that costs a fortune, far more money than he or I could raise. And how do you feel about him? Merthyn winced. Well, he deserves punishment for what he did, of course. All the same, I can't wish it on him. I just hope he's all right, wherever he is. He had told the story of Ralph's trial many times in the last few days, but Elizabeth had asked the most astute questions. She was intelligent and sympathetic. The thought crossed his mind that it would be no hardship to spend every Sunday afternoon this way. Her mother, Sarah, was dozing by the fire as usual, but now she opened her eyes and said, "My soul! I've forgotten the pie!" She stood up, patting her must-grey hair. "I promised to ask Betty Baxter to make a pie with ham and eggs for the Leather Tanners Guild. They're holding their last before Lent dinner at the Bell tomorrow." She draped a blanket around her shoulders and went out. It was unusual for them to be left alone together, and Merthyn felt slightly awkward, but Elizabeth seemed relaxed enough. She said, "What are you doing with yourself, now that you no longer work on the bridge?" "I'm building a house for Dick Brewer, among other things. Dick's ready to retire and hand over to his son, but he says he'll never stop work while he's living at the Copper, so he wants a house with a garden outside the old city walls."
"Oh, is that the building site beyond Lover's Field?"
"Yes, it will be the biggest house in Kingsbridge.
A brewer is never short of money."
"Would you like to see it?"
"The site?
The house? It's not finished, but it's got 4 walls and a roof."
"Now?"
"There's still an hour of daylight." She hesitated, as if she might have had another plan, but then she said,
"I'd love to."
They put on heavy cloaks with hoods and went out. It was the first day of March. Flurries of snow chased them down the main street. They took the ferry to the suburban side. Despite the ups and downs of the wool trade, the town seemed to grow a little every year. and the priory turned more and more of its pasture and orchards into house plots for rent. Merthyn guessed there must be 50 dwellings that had not been here when he first came to Kingsbridge as a boy 12 years ago. Dick Brewer's new home was a 2-story structure set back from the road.